现在到底在哪里？我到哪才能找到你？你把我丢在街上就离去，原因是我不在你。你的爱你知道我需要，可转眼我的一切没有了。你的眼睛实在太美丽，无法忘记，忘记在每个夜里。
Welcome to the Circumference podcast series. I'm your host, Montana Ray, and today I'm so honored to be talking to Elliot Weinberger. Elliot, could you start by telling me how you learned Spanish?
First of all, I should say that the strange thing for me about interviews is that in my own writing, I never write anything autobiographical, and I almost never use the first person singular. So it's very strange for me that in interviews one ends up talking about oneself a lot. Like last fall, I was in Australia at a few literary festivals and did some on-stage interviews, and they kept asking me about my childhood. And I'd say, why do you want to know about my childhood? Why don't you ask me about Obama or something? Anyway, I can't really say that I know Spanish in the sense that I've never lived in a Spanish-speaking country, so that the bells will be nice in your podcast. This is actually being recorded in a church. I've never lived in a Spanish-speaking country, so that there's huge areas of Spanish that I don't know. I could have a perfectly fluent conversation with a literary critic, but I wouldn't be able to talk to a plumber or an auto mechanic. So I have a kind of rarefied Spanish. I don't really have much formal education, and I mainly learned by reading and by traveling in Latin America.
And how did you meet Paz?
Okay, this story starts way back. When I was 13 years old, I discovered accidentally Muriel Rukeyser's translation of Paz's Sunstone. And it was the first modern poem that I ever read. And it was the proverbial book that changed my life. And after I read that, I decided I wanted to be a writer. Before that, I wanted to be an archaeologist. And so in high school, I was translating various poets to learn how to write poetry, mainly Paz, but also obvious people like Neruda and Lope and Vallejo. Then when I was 18, I met someone who knew Paz. And so I said, well, I've got all these translations sitting in my drawer. And this guy sent them to Paz, who was then the ambassador in India. And Paz liked them a lot and asked me to translate his book of prose poetry, Eagler Sun. So at the time, I had gone to college for 1 year, and I had dropped out, and I was a hippie dropout, and I wasn't doing anything. And so I thought, well, now I can, you know, tell my parents I have something to do. I'm translating a book by Octavio Paz. So that, and then I met him shortly after that, after he resigned his post as ambassador in India after the massacre of the students in 1968. He kind of floated around and then ended up, strangely enough, in Pittsburgh very briefly, because he thought Pittsburgh was near New York City. And I went down and met him in Pittsburgh in 68. So that was the first time that we actually met. And I think he was a little shocked to see this, you know, hippie with beads and Tibetan shirt and everything as his translator.
You have a new book of Paz translations coming out with new directions in the fall. Would you read from that book?
I'll preface this by saying that I hadn't really translated too much Paz in recent years, and then finally I've put together this book, which New Directions has wanted for a long time, which is a kind of, it's sort of bigger than a selected, smaller than a collected. It's a kind of retrospective of his poetry from his first published poem at age 17 until his last published poem. And it's about a 600-page book that's coming out this fall. And because of that, I had to not only translate a lot of new things for it, but also revise my old translations, some of which go back to when I was a teenager. And so I'm looking at these translations, and I'm thinking, I can't even recuperate what was in my mind at the time that made me do this, you know? And so I rewrote those. So this poem, which just came out in Paris Review, is called Target Practice, and it's one of his last poems. His very last poem, curiously, his very last poem, which is called Response and Reconciliation, is one of his best poems ever. So he kind of went out at the top and not at the bottom. Target Practice. The tide covers, discovers, recovers, and always walks in the nude. The tide weaves and unweaves, embraces and separates, is never the same and never another. The tide, sculptor of forms that last as long as their surge. The tide breaks rocks, polishes conchs. The tide always assaults itself. The tide, surge of syllables of the interminable word, without beginning or end, spoken by the moon. The tide is angry, and on some nights, beating against the rock coast, it announces the end of the world. The tide, transparency crowned with white caps that vanish. The perpetual tide, the unstable tide, the punctual tide. The tide and its daggers, its swords, its tattered flags, the conquered, the victorious. The tide, green spittle. The tide, sleeping on the chest of the sun, dreaming of the moon. The tide, blue and black, green and purple, dressed in the sun and undressed in the moon, spark of noon and heaving breath of night. The tide at night, murmur of bare feet on the sand. The tide at dawn opens the eyelids of the day. The tide breathes in the deep night, and sleeping speaks in dreams. The tide that licks the corpses that the coast throws at it. The tide races, rises, races, howls, knocks down the door, breaks the furniture, and then, on the shore, softly weeps. The tide, mad woman writing indecipherable signs on the rocks, signs of death. The sand guards the secrets of the tide. Who is the tide talking to all night long? The tide is honest and eventually returns all of its drowned. Storms come and go, the tide remains. The tide, hard-working washerwoman of the filth that people leave on the beach. The tide does not remember where it came from or where it's going, lost in its coming and going, between itself, among itself. There, at the cliffs, the tide closes its fist and threatens the earth and sky. The tide is immortal. Its tomb is a cradle. The tide chained to its surge. The melancholy of the tide under the rain in the vagaries of dawn. The tide knocks down the trees and swallows the town. The tide, an oily stain spreading with its millions of dead fish. The tide, its breasts, its belly, its hips, its thighs, beneath the lips and between the arms of the wind in heat. The spring of sweet water leaps from the rocks and falls into the bitter tide. The tide, mother of gods and goddess herself, the long nights weeping on the islands of Ionia, the death of Pan. The tide contaminated with chemical waste, the tide that poisons the planet. The tide, the living carpet on which the constellations walk on tiptoes. The tide, lioness whipped into fury by the hurricane, panther tamed by the moon. The beggar, the nuisance, the bore, the tide. Lightning slips into the chest of the tide, plunges, disappears, and is reborn, turned into a little foam. The yellow tide, the hired mourner and her flock of laments, the bilious and her wealth in complaints. The tide, does it walk asleep or awake? Whispers, laughter, murmurs, the coming and going of the tide in the coral gardens of the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, in the cove of Unawatuna. The tide, horizon that drifts off, hypnosis mirror that mesmerizes lovers. The tide with liquid hands opens the deserted lands populated by the gaze of the contemplative. The tide lifts these words, rocks them for a moment, and then, with a swipe, erases them.
Thank you. So what do you make of the title, Target Practice?
I have no idea what it means. This is one of the problems of no longer having Paz around to ask him. I thought, you know, for a while, I thought, well, it's ejercicio de tiro in Spanish. And I thought, well, maybe that has some other meaning. So I asked various Mexicans, but no, it only means target practice. So I have no idea what the title means, but it's a literal translation. There's advantages and disadvantages to translating living or dead authors. When it's a living author, you get to ask him or her questions. But of course, if it's a dead author, then they don't, you know, oversee your translation and tell you how terrible it is, you know, how you've misunderstood things. But it's curious, in translating Paz, one thing that I think never gets talked about in translation is what it's like to be translated. And it's interesting because when an author reads a translation, the author becomes a reader of his or her own works. When I was translating Paz, I was often translating things in manuscript before they'd been published in Spanish. And then when Paz read the translations, he saw things that he didn't like in the original and then changed a word or two here and there in his original because somehow he had become a reader of his own work through the translation, and he could see things that he didn't like. Garcia Marquez very famously said that he preferred Gregory Rabassa's version, 100 Years of Solitude, to the original. But I think, and Paz once said the same thing, he once said, well, I have doubts about myself in Spanish, but I love myself in English, which is not really about the value of the translation as much as it's about the act of reading oneself in translation, I think, so that you suddenly become, and you don't become the author anymore, you become the reader.
Do you think that he was writing for an English-speaking audience? Was he writing for translation, for recognition?
I don't think that's necessarily true at all, no, I mean, because he... you know, obviously he was an international poet, but I don't think he was thinking about... I think that's a kind of a phony academic thing these days, that certain writers are writing for translation.
Mm-hmm.
I know this was the criticism of Beidou,
mm-hmm.
which is completely absurd,
mm-hmm.
you know, this idea that, no, they're just writing for translation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's true at all among poets.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I mean, possibly prose writers, since there is this sense of being able to make some money when your book is published in English or published abroad, possibly there is that sense of explaining localisms,
mm-hmm.
and that's come up. I mean, so if you're an Indian writer, instead of saying Bindi, saying a red dot on the forehead, you know, that sort of thing. But among poets, I don't think that that's ever actually true.
You worked on a book in conjunction with Octavio Paz called 19 Ways of Looking at Wang Wei, How a Chinese Poem is Translated. Would you talk about that book? I see it as a translator's manual of sorts.
So this book takes 19 different translations of the same four-line poem by the Tang Dynasty poet Wang Wei, and then has a little commentary about each. I think it gets used in courses a lot just because people don't realize this idea that a poem can be translated many, many different ways, which comes as a revelation. I mean, we know it, but it comes as a revelation to a number of people. And also that one has to pay attention to the smallest words in the translation, and that the translation often turns on the smallest words.
Would you read your favorite and your least favorite translations from the book?
Let's see, my favorite translations and my least favorite translations. Okay. Among my favorites, well, there's a couple of things. One is Burton Watson, which seems to be the most straightforward of all of the translations. Burton Watson is the greatest translator of classical Chinese, into any language. He's done a massive amount of work of poetry, philosophy, religious texts, history, now in his 80s and still going strong. Watson is a sinologist, but he's also somebody who is thoroughly aware of contemporary American poetry. And, for example, back in the 1970s, I had a magazine called Montemora, and for the first issue I wrote to all the people I liked the most and asked them to contribute, one of whom was Watson, and he sent me some translations. And then after the first issue came out, he wrote me a letter and said, "I can't tell you how honored I am to be in the same magazine as Charles Reznikoff." And Charles Reznikoff at that time was an extremely obscure poet. And so Watson is also very connected to Gary Snyder and various beat poets and so forth and so on. And it's curious because among the sinologists, the two who I think are the best translators are both people who really know contemporary American poetry very well, Watson and David Hinton. What's obvious but is rarely thought about is that translation comes from somewhere, but it also goes somewhere. And often foreign language department translators know everything about the original, but they know nothing about where their translation is going, which is the context of if you're translating into English now, contemporary American poetry or prose, which is why their translations are so dead. And there's really only two sinologists that I think know anything about contemporary poetry. So anyway, Watson, what's amazing about Watson is that he takes 20 characters in Chinese and manages to translate it into 24 words in English without resorting to any sort of pidgin English the way some other translators of classical Chinese have done. Deer fence. Empty hills, no one in sight. Only the sound of someone talking. Late sunlight enters the deep wood, shining over the green moss again. Now, one of my least favorite, of course, there's some 19th century ones that are pretty dreadful, but one of my least favorite is actually from a tremendously influential book, which was Witter Binner and Kiang Kang Hu's The Jade Mountain from 1929. Which is a book loved by people like Rex Roth and also Burton Watson. But this seems to me I'll read it and then we'll talk about it. Deer Park Hermitage. There seems to be no one on the empty mountain, and yet I think I hear a voice where sunlight entering the grove shines back to me from the green moss. And This story struck me as very Orientalist kind of translation because everything becomes sort of ethereal, whereas the Chinese basically says, as in Watson's translation, empty hills or empty mountain, no one in sight. Binner turns it into, there seems to be no one on the empty, and then Watson has only the sound of someone talking, and Binner has, and yet I think I hear a voice. So everything where Wang Wei is incredibly direct, no one on the empty mountain, I hear a voice, or there's no first person in Chinese, one hears a voice. Binner turns it into this kind of sort of misty, chinoiserie kind of translation. I'll read one more, which is Gary Snyder. Empty mountains, no one to be seen, yet here, human sounds and echoes. Returning sunlight enters the dark woods, again shining on the green moss above. Chinese has no tenses in their verbs. And so Gary interestingly turns that here into an imperative. Instead of saying voices are heard or I hear a voice or something, says yet hear human voices, human sounds and echoes.
Great, thank you. Could you talk about your own engagement with Chinese, studying the language for a decade?
Well, I'm from the school of Ezra Pound, so there, you know, and so I since I wasn't going to college, I followed the Ezra University, as it's called, of all the things you need to know to be a poet, which included things like reading all of the English poetry in chronological order, and, you know, learning enough Italian to study, you know, read Dante, and messing around with Provençal, reading the troubadours, and of course, learning Chinese. I spent about 7 or 8 years studying Chinese, taking some courses, and also on my own, and mainly classical Chinese. And at the end of which, I sort of had the literacy of about a 16-year-old and the fluency of about a 3-year-old, though probably less fluent than your 3-year-old. But the problem with Chinese is it's so immensely difficult. You either devote your life to it or you don't. And so by the time I was age 30, I decided I was too much of a dilettante, and so I kind of gave it up. But I've kept my interest in classical Chinese poetry, but also modern poetry. I was good friends with Beidou, and then David Hinton had been translating him, but David really only likes to do classical Chinese, and so he didn't want to do Beidou's new book. So Beidou somehow roped me into attempting to translate Unlock, and then I've since been translating all of his new poems. And the way I did it was to have, basically my Chinese now is I know all the structures of Chinese, but I don't have the vocabulary. So for example, when I'm in China, what I hear on the street is, hi, do you want to go to blank? No, thanks, I'd rather go to blank, you know, or that sort of thing. So I kind of have these grammatical structures and basic vocabulary without a lot of specific vocabulary. So what I did for Unlock was I got a friend of mine who's a Chinese historian to basically, first of all, transliterate the poems into pinyin, which is the system of romanization. Because, as you probably know, Chinese, it's very hard to... It takes a long time to look up each character when you just have the written character. But if you have the transliteration, it really speeds up dictionary time. And then to do a kind of literal word-for-word translation of that. And then after that, I just worked from the dictionaries, and then also consulted with Beidou. Then after this book Unlocked for the Rose of Time Selected Poems, I was working with Beidou himself, and we basically would just sit around and go line by line through the poems and with dictionaries and so forth and figure out how to do it.
Great. Would you read a couple of the poems from Unlocked?
Yeah. Well, why don't I read one from Unlocked and one from Rose of Time?
Great.
Okay. June. Wind at the ear says, June. June, a blacklist I slipped in time. Note this way to say goodbye, the size within these words. Note these annotations, unending plastic flowers on the dead left bank. The cement square extending from writing to now. I run from writing, as dawn is hammered out, a flag covers the sea, and loudspeakers, loyal to the sea's deep bass, say, June. June, of course, being June 4th, Tiananmen Square.
And here's Beidou reading Yuvie.
Yuvie. 风在耳边说, Yuvie. Yuvie 是张黑名单,我提前离席。 请注意告别方式，那些词的叹息。请注意那些诠释，无边的塑料花在死亡左岸 水泥广场从写作中延伸到此刻，我从写作中逃跑，当黎明被锻造，旗帜盖住大海，而忠实于大海的低音喇叭说，六月。
You're listening to the Circumference podcast series. That was Bei Dao reading his poem Juvier. Elliot, would you like to pick another poem to read?
I guess I'll read the title poem from Rose of Time Selected Poems. When the watchman falls asleep, you turn back with the moon. To grow old embracing is the rose of time. When bird roads define the sky, you look behind at the sunset. To emerge in disappearance is the rose of time. When the knife is bent in water, you cross the bridge, stepping on flute songs. To cry in the conspiracy is the rose of time. When a pen draws the horizon, you're awakened by a gong from the east. To bloom in the echoes is the rose of time. In the mirror, there is always this moment. This moment leads to the door of rebirth. The door opens to the sea, the rose of time.
And here's Bei Dao reading Shi Jin de Migui. Shi
Jin de Migui. 当守门人沉睡，你和风暴一起转身，拥抱中老去的是时间的玫瑰。当鸟鹭界定天空，你回望那落日，消失中呈现的是时间的玫瑰。当刀在水中折弯，你踏笛声过桥，密谋中哭喊的是时间的玫瑰。当笔划出地平线，你被东方之罗惊醒，回声中开放的是时间的玫瑰。镜中永远是此刻，此刻通向重生之门，那门开向大海，时间的玫瑰。
You were listening to Bei Dao read his poem, Xianten de Meigui. Elliot, I wanted to talk about what Octavio Paz writes in 19 Ways of Looking at Wang Wei, specifically that Spanish is not received much Chinese through translation, and that the language has been impoverished by this lack of interaction with Chinese as compared to English. Did you ever talk to him about that?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that Spanish, because, 20th century American poetry is inextricable from classical Chinese poetry, and Ezra Pound's Cafe is really the first book of modern poetry in English, surprisingly, and of course it's translations from mainly Tang Dynasty poets. Mm-hmm. And curiously, Spanish has never had that at all. In fact, very weirdly, a few years ago, they translated Rex Roth's 100 poems from the Chinese into Spanish from the English. And I was reading this review of it, and it was sort of talking about, this strange curiosity, Chinese poetry. Who knew that this was of interest and so forth? And so for us, this is completely unimaginable because there have been so many different kinds of. Chinese poetry has had its influence on American poetry in so many different ways. Mm. Both precision of the concrete image, nature poetry, politically engaged poetry, the kind of collage effect or the jump cuts of poetry. A lot of this has come out of either came directly out of Chinese poetry or was things that people were doing which they recognized in Chinese poetry, in classical Chinese poetry. Whereas Spanish hasn't had that at all. And Paz was really the only important poet that I know of to become engaged with Chinese poetry. In contrast, however, Japanese haiku is tremendously influential in Spanish. Mm. And there's really haiku mania in Spanish starting in the 20s. And Lorca, for very influenced by haiku, the Apollinaire of Spanish is Jose Juan Tablada, a Mexican poet who lived in Japan, who wrote calligrams, really introduced the calligram into Spanish, and also wrote wonderful haikus. So the haiku has kept going in Spanish, whereas Chinese poetry never really had much traction, as they say.
Elliot, I wanted to switch gears and talk about your book of political essays, What Happened Here, Bush Chronicles. First of all, thank you for this book. Second of all, I had read online that you had said that the Bush junta was good for translation. And I know you said this rather cheekily, but I wondered if you could explain that comment to me.
Basically, I think that one of the great spurs for translation is a national inferiority complex or a national self-loathing. And if you look at American poetry, you have really three great moments of translation in modern times. The first is in early modernism, when so many of the Americans had decamped to Europe, when they felt that America was a provincial country, which it was, and they wanted to insert themselves into world literature, and the way one of the ways that they felt that they could do that was by doing a tremendous amount of translation. It's in the 1910s, 1920s. Then translation sort of tapers off, and then the next great boom in translation is in the 1960s. During the Vietnam War, civil rights movement, and so on, when American intellectuals were really embarrassed to be Americans for good reason, we got tired of hearing about ourselves and wanted to hear what, you know, people in other parts of the world had to say. And that's when you have this tremendous boom in translation. And curiously, I mean, if you look at American poetry from about 1910 to about 1975, it's very hard to come up with more than a few American poets who did not translate at least something. And almost everyone translated at least one book, and many of them translated much more. There's only a few exceptions, like Robert Frost, Wallace Stevens, and so forth. But basically, every American poet translated. Then, beginning around 1975, American poets sort of stopped translating, except for the old-timers who were around in the 60s. I mean, people like the Waldrops and Merwin, mm-hmm. and so forth, Jerry Rothenberg, and so forth. They kept translating, but you don't have this new generation of translators, with only one or two exceptions. And translation just doesn't become something that a young poet feels that he or she needs to do. It's no longer part of community service. I attribute that to a kind of complacency about being American, but also the emphasis on careerism that came in with the rise of the creative writing schools. So that sense of community service was not as present as it had been in the past. But then with the Bush era, the Iraq War, I mean, once again, we were sick of being Americans. We were embarrassed to be Americans and wanted to hear what other people had to say, particularly from Arabic, from mm-hmm. the people we were bombing. You know, beginning around 2000 or so and picking up during the first decade, you have this tremendous boom in translations, presses publishing translations, conferences on translations, and so forth and so on. So actually we're in, I think, a third boom period where lots of young poets are starting to translate again, where there's a tremendous amount of interest. And this is extremely healthy because you had this kind of 25-year gap where people really didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world. In that sense, I mean, it's hard to remember that, say, in the 60s, just to talk about Latin America, people like Paz or Nicanor Parra or Neruda or many, many others were basically their books were being translated a year or two or sometimes simultaneously to their appearance in Spanish, so that you had this sense of a kind of living international of poetry, which then kind of died out, at least in English, and now I think it's coming back much more, so we're much more aware of what is being written in other languages right now.
So you don't find it problematic the way we seem to package our translations with our bombs, or we only seem interested in listening closely to a culture after we've bombed its country? I'm reminded of an interview I did with Amiel Alkalay, who is the translator for Smezda Mimadinovic, and there was a market for that work because of the war in the former Yugoslavia.
it's true that of course we tend to be interested in crisis zones, and then that you know that translates into literature. So mm-hmm. I mean, so during the wars in the Balkans, you know, suddenly there is this, mm-hmm. this interest in Bosnian literature,
mm-hmm.
which then tends to move on, you know, to the next crisis. So, but that's human nature. You know, that's like slowing down for the car wreck. The difference, though, is that when you have a crisis zone, there's an interest in the literature in general.
Mm-hmm.
But what remains after that crisis is no longer something in the news,
mm-hmm.
is that I think the really best writers then manage to survive, you know, and mm-hmm. so then you have tremendous interest in individual writers,
mm-hmm.
more than in a mm-hmm. literature in general.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's so unhealthy either,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so of course, there's different kinds of translation. There's a translation that kind of looks at the literature in general, and then there's a translation that is more focused on individual writers.
Yeah.
So it's that perennial question: is it better to do an anthology of 25 Bulgarian writers, or is it better to translate
mm.
the person that you think is the greatest Bulgarian poet
mm-hmm.
into? Well, I mean, ideally, you should have both. So one is a kind of survey; the other is, you know, is presenting that individual author.
Well, and who do the Bulgarians think is the best writer? You know, and talking
yeah, but
to
who the Bulgarians think is not necessarily who's the best person to translate,
mm.
because the whole point of translation is to bring into your language things that don't exist in your language. And often it happens that a greatly esteemed writer in another language is not someone that would seem all that different in English, let's
mm-hmm.
say, or all that you know, mm. astonishing. I've been a judge often for the Penn Translation Prize and often get proposals for projects of something that's considered, say, well, since we're in Bulgaria, Bulgaria, that will say, okay, this is the most influential Bulgarian novel of the 19th century, and this is the book that changed Bulgarian literature,
mm.
and it will be a kind of, you know, realist novel about peasants growing potatoes and so forth and so on,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we already have, like, so many realist novels about peasants growing potatoes
mm.
that somehow it doesn't seem all that important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's tremendously important in Bulgaria, but not necessarily here. And the same problem with the NEA sponsoring these anthologies of translation of Mexican poetry, Chinese poetry, various things. And once again, they have people from that country
mm-hmm.
picking the poems. But it's not necessarily what's going to be most interesting for readers here
mm-hmm.
at all. So.
Elliot, I'd love to end by reading some of your own work. Would you read Abu Alambas's Donkey from An Elemental Thing, your book of essays published by New Directions?
It's kind of a joke for translators, actually. Abu Alambas's Donkey. Abu al-Hasan Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abd Allah al-Masudi, the 10th century historian from Baghdad, city of peace, tells the story of a man named Abu al-Anbas, who lived during the reign of Mutawakkil, who abolished free thought and philosophical disputes, reestablished the orthodoxy, severely enforced traditional religious values, gave little to the poor, built two palaces worth 100 million dirhams, and devoted himself to board games, banquets, and each of his 4,000 concubines. Abu al-Anbas had a favorite donkey who suddenly dies. One night the donkey appeared to him in a dream, and Abu spoke to him. "Oh, my donkey, didn't I always give you the coolest and freshest water? Wasn't I always sifting the barley I gave you? Why did you suddenly die?" The donkey replied, "My master, I'm sorry. One day you stopped at the apothecary, and the most beautiful donkey girl passed by. I saw her. My heart was stricken, and I loved her with such a violent passion that in the end I succumbed to despair. Did you write a poem about her? I did indeed. It goes, my heart was stricken by a donkey girl as I waited for my master by the door of the apothecary. She enslaved me with her coy demeanor and her two soft cheeks, the color of Shankarani. I died for her, for if I had lived, my passion would have only grown worse. Your poem is moving, said Abu al-Anbas. But what does Shankarani mean? Oh, that's an old word. You only hear it these days in donkey poetry.
Great. So what is the relationship between translation and the inaccessible words? How do you translate something that is unnamed, that is an absence?
Yeah, but I mean, of course, it's the nature of poetry that it's always circling around the unnameable also. I mean, because, you know, the origin of poetry is in taboo and is in the idea of creating metaphors for things that cannot be named. So in that sense, poetry is always being constructed around an absence, and translation is also constructed around that absence. I mean, this gets into the kind of religious practice of translation, which is all about sublimation of the ego. One of the wonderful things about translation, and why, you know, nerds like me are particularly attracted to translation, is this idea of the dissolution of the ego, and the sense that you are not the author, that you are more the vehicle, which many poets have, of course, believed about themselves also. I mean, you know, Jack Spicer always said, I'm a radio, and so forth. I'm just receiving these transmissions. But in translation, you actually are the radio and transmitting this text through whatever your individual tuning in is of the original that's coming over the radio waves. So in that sense, that idea of sublimation of the ego, then it does become a healthy religious practice, you know, like meditation.
And what about for the listener? How is it a sacred experience to hear an untranslated word or a word you can't bring into your own context?
Words also retain their power even when you don't know the meaning. You know? So this is the function of having the Mass in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exactly. And so does the Mass become any more moving once it's translated into English for parishioners? I'm not so sure that it does. You know?
Mm-hmm. And that concludes this installment of the Circumference podcast series. I'm your host, Montana Ray. I'd like to say thank you to Abby Lavin for sending me some tunes from Shanghai, and also a huge thank you to Elliot Weinberger.
Shen shen shang hai, shen di zhen. 随死亡而来的比死亡更可怕、伴随现实而来的比现实更复杂、伴随死亡而来的比死亡更可怕、我被你的行为有深深伤害，
这些年轻人都在想些什么？太混乱了。
想要你就